From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And as we count down to Friday and the inauguration of the 45th President of the United States, we heard today from Congressman John Lewis at an event for Martin Luther King Day, and he never mentioned the tweets from Donald Trump that have gotten so much attention over the past couple days. Joining us now is NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And let's go through this story for people who were more focused maybe on relaxing than the news over the weekend. Late last week, John Lewis, who is a civil rights icon, who was beaten by policemen during the civil rights march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma back in 1965, came out and said he's not going to the inauguration and he doesn't think Trump is a legitimate president because of the Russian hacking leading up to the election. Here he is speaking with Chuck Todd on NBC.
I don't plan to attend inauguration. It would be the first one that I miss since I've been in the Congress. You cannot be at home with something that you feel that is wrong.
So Trump fired back on Twitter saying Lewis should spend more of his time helping his district, which he called crime infested. People were shocked by all of this. But then no comment from Lewis today, and he's been tweeting about Martin Luther King, but no response to what Donald Trump said about him. What do you make of all of this, Ron?
First of all, I think it should be said that John Lewis was on Meet the Press. He was asked if he was going to inauguration. He said he wasn't. And then, of course, the question arises, when is he not going? And then John Lewis said because he did not view Donald Trump's election as legitimate and pointed toward the interference in the election, or at least in the campaign. Let's make a distinction between Election Day and the campaign over the many months leading up to it, by the Russians, particularly led by Vladimir Putin. So that is something that is obviously deeply troubling to John Lewis, and he does not want to be associated with the inauguration. Then over the weekend, of course, Donald Trump hit back, and if John Lewis had any doubt that Donald Trump would hit back, he doesn't know Donald Trump. And he said that John Lewis should help him, that is to say, help the president-elect, in addressing the burning problems of the inner cities. And he also strongly implied that there was something wrong with John Lewis's district. John Lewis's district includes a lot of metropolitan Atlanta, including some of the wealthiest neighborhoods of the airport and Emory University.
Right, as well as the Capitol, I believe, and some major companies like Delta and Coca-Cola. So that has been going on, and that has been attracting a lot of attention. But then today, Trump came out in an interview in the Washington Post and talked about some of the big policy issues he wants to do right away and said with the repeal of the Affordable Care Act that his goal with the replacement is to get insurance for everybody. That's a quote. And here's the incoming press secretary, Sean Spicer, speaking on the Today Show this morning.
What he said in the Washington Post article, Willie, was his goal was to get insurance for everybody.
Right.
Through marketplace solutions, through competition, through bringing costs down, negotiating with pharmaceutical companies, allowing competition over state lines. There's a lot of ways that we can bring the cost and access to health care way down to ensure that people actually get additional plans to choose from, more doctors in the system, and health care at a much cheaper option than it is currently.
Ron, do we have any more idea of what the replacement is going to be or when we're going to know what's happening with Obamacare?
There seems to be something of a disconnect here between what Donald Trump is talking about, which would be insurance for everyone at lower premiums and lower deductibles. So a lot of money is going to have to come into the system from somewhere unless we're expecting hospitals and doctors to donate all of this care. And that is not quite what Sean Spicer said this morning when he said that it could all be done through existing mechanisms that Republicans have been talking about doing for many, many years, the sort of small ball approach of taking it, such things as selling insurance policies across state lines to encourage more competition and theoretically lower costs, although we don't really know where that has ever been tried and worked.
Just briefly, Ron, one other policy issue that Trump touched on is tax cuts. He wants to do that right away for corporations and for individuals. Do we have any more details about that? And do we think that some deficit hawks in the GOP are going to fight him on it?
It's just notional in terms of the details we have at this point. Lowering the corporate rate to 15 is a great idea, supported by many, many people very broadly. But, of course, you have to actually enforce the 15. Right now, the rate is higher, but nobody, or not nobody, but very few companies actually pay
right.
the top rate. On the personal side, half the people in the United States do not now pay personal income tax. So any cut in the personal income tax would not touch a big chunk of the middle class.
That's NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So Donald Trump is using Twitter as the new bully pulpit. We'll see how long that lasts with products. The Office of Ethics prohibits the president from endorsing organizations, businesses, products, or people. But Donald Trump was still the president-elect when he sent out that tweet supporting Linda Bean of the outdoor company L.L. Bean, who reportedly donated $60,000 to the pro-Trump super PAC, Making America Great Again. Trump tweeted, "People will support you even more now. Buy L.L. Bean," to which the group grabbed your wallet said, "Boycott L.L. Bean." Now, L.L. Bean says the company doesn't take political positions, that Linda Bean is only one family member out of 50. So let's bring in Grab Your Wallet founder Shannon Coulter from San Francisco by Skype. Shannon, what about that? It was just one family member, and 4 years ago, Linda Bean's cousin supported Barack Obama. No outcry.
Yeah, for us, it's really not about corporate leaders not supporting politicians. It's about corporate leaders not supporting highly divisive candidates and causes. Many consumers just aren't comfortable with the possibility that their hard-earned money might go towards somebody who could use it to fund the rise of yet more highly divisive figures. It's about understanding how our past purchases might have inadvertently contributed to the combative tone we see in our country today and actively moving towards something more positive.
Let's be more direct. You're saying this is about Donald Trump.
Yes, it's specifically about Donald, although this isn't the first time that Linda Bean has landed L.L. Bean in the news negatively. She's a part of some pretty controversial groups and causes, and I think it would be unrealistic for any national brand to have its corporate leadership getting involved in things like that and expect the public not to find out about it and to object to that.
Could you tick off some of those, the Linda Bean associations?
Yeah. Southern Poverty Law Center has identified a group called the Council for National Policy. They did a very deep investigation of that. So Linda Bean is involved in anti-LGBT Islamophobic groups. You know, these are the kinds of things that are available to consumers today, and they make judgment calls based on this kind of information.
Well, so here you have this hashtag. What other companies are you urging people not to support?
So there are two main kinds of companies that people are interested in who are participating in Grab Your Wallet. The first kind are retailers who have a direct business relationship with the Trump family. So a company like Amazon that sells both Donald and Ivanka Trump clothes, shoes. And then the second category, which is de-emphasized and is kind of more of like an FYI category, is about companies with corporate leaders at the C-suite level and the board level who have either endorsed Donald Trump or did some fundraising for him or did fundraising for PACs that were supportive of Trump.
Well, some would say when it comes to Donald Trump, he's somebody who's used his tweets, used his bullhorn to try to take down companies he disagrees with. He criticized H&R Block, of course, Boeing. So he's done the same thing.
He has done the same thing repeatedly, which makes it particularly ironic that Linda Bean has referred to boycotts as bullying.
Do you feel at all badly about the workers at these companies who really don't have a choice? They're not thinking about who their corporate leaders are donating to in political campaigns. They're in there, you know, in this case, making boots. Do you feel badly that they're the ones also that are getting punished?
One point to make about that is that all of the companies that we're supporting now also have employees, and we're very happy to support those companies and hopefully to contribute to those companies being able to hire more employees. The second thing to say about that is that, again, I think for brands, especially high-profile brands like L.L. Bean, it would be wildly naive to believe that your board members and C-suite members can contribute to and support and endorse highly divisive candidates and causes without consumers finding out about that and making a judgment call about that. If companies aren't already doing that as a part of their risk assessment, they probably should start.
What does L.L. Bean have to do for you? The donations been given. How do they get removed from your list?
That's a very important question, because successful boycotts do give the companies on the list a way to get off of the list. And I proactively reach out to all the companies on the list to let them know what that is. Mm-hmm. L.L. Bean is a little bit odd in the sense that Linda Bean is a member of the Bean family, obviously. So there may be limitations on how much the current company leadership can separate from her. I think, however, that voting her off of the board would be a concrete, very symbolic action that they could take that would probably be enough for most Grab Your Wallet participants to start shopping with them again, which is something that they're very anxious to do.
So you've taken the stand, but you are taking it in a pretty vicious climate. What's been the attacks on your group?
I am not only getting threats now, which I'm used to because I've been getting them for a long time, but now the participants are starting to get threats, which really bothers me even more than getting them personally.
Shannon Coulter, the founder of the boycott movement Grab Your Wallet. Shannon, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Academy Award nominations are going to be announced next week. That is when the 15 films on the shortlist for Best Documentary Feature will be narrowed down to 5. The movies cover topics including O.J. Simpson, a Kazakh girl who trains an eagle to hunt, and the fall of Congressman Anthony Weiner. Also on the list, Life Animated. That documentary picks up where Ron Suskind's 2014 book of the same name left off, telling the story of how Suskind, his wife, and their older son Walt used Disney films to communicate with the younger son, Owen, who has autism. Owen later used Disney films to connect with others.
I started a Disney club so I can get to know more people and they can be around me so I can be more popular.
Life Animated follows Owen, who is now a young man, as he finishes school and moves into his own apartment. We spoke with him, as well as the film's director, Roger Ross Williams, and executive producer Ron Suskind last June. And Ron Suskind started by telling us what happened with Owen.
Okay, so Owen is about 2.5. He starts to lose speech. And after a few months, his 200-word vocabulary for a 2.5-year-old is down to a single word, juice. He can't make eye contact. He walks like someone with their eyes closed. And soon enough, someone sits us down and uses the word autism. And what we found is that he loved the Disney movies with his older brother before the onset. It seemed like the only thing he wanted to do after. He just wanted to watch those movies. So between all the therapies and everything else, that's what he did. He'd rewind movies. So about a year into this silence, Owen is murmuring, "Juicervos, Juicervos." And we think it's just gibberish. It sounds at least like a baby. And he's watching The Little Mermaid. We're all together. And of course, what scene is he rewinding? The part where Ariel loses her voice, has to make a trade with the Sea Witch to become human. And the Sea Witch says, "It won't cost much. It's a trifle, really. Just your voice."
So he wasn't saying Juicervos. He was saying just your voice.
Just your voice.
"It won't cost much. Just your voice."
And at that moment, I grab Owen, and we begin a moment of really a journey where we say, maybe he is in there, and maybe he knows what he's saying. This jumps ahead several years. He's almost 7 years old, and he offers his first major sentence where Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan. We say, oh, my God, he's using these movies to make sense of the world, our world. And at that instant, a light went on. That night, I go up to his room. I speak to him in the voice of Gilbert Gottfried. I say in Gilbert's voice, "Owen, Owen, how does it feel to be you?" And what do you say?
"Not good, because I don't have any friends."
And I'm lonely. And Owen and I start to talk. It was really the puppet and Owen. After a few minutes of this, Owen clears his throat and says to me what?
"I love the way your foul little mind works."
That's Jafar, the villain. Of course, Yaga's the sidekick to Jafar in Aladdin. Oh, at that moment, a light goes on. We're speaking in Disney dialogue. We begin years playing animated characters in the basement. Over years, Owen gets his speech back little by little. He learns to read by reading credits and then emerges as a teenager into a kind of genius on animation. And that brings us to this moment where people around the world are saying, wait a second, Of course, he's using his passion as a pathway. It's not a prison. It's a way to understand himself, his place in the world. And that's the story of Life Animated.
And I can't believe I even have to ask this after hearing that story. And this is a story that we've known now for a couple of years as we've read this book. But Roger Ross Williams, what drew you to this story? What is it that you loved about it?
I've known Ron for a long time. I've known him for 15 years. So when he was writing the book, he came to me and said, you know, I think this will make a good documentary. And I jumped on it because this is really about a film about the power of story, about the power of love of one family. And for me, I always saw it as a coming of age story. You know, Owen goes through all the things that we all go through in our life. He graduates from college and he falls in love for the first time. And then he strikes out on his own and becomes independent. And so the film picks up where the book leaves off, and it follows him in this fairly transformational year of his life.
Owen, what was it like for you to have all these cameras around?
Oh, it was a little uncomfortable at first, but then over time I started to get used to it.
Well, Owen, what do you think about this story of your life and the fact that it's now being told in a book and in a movie and has inspired so many people?
It feels fascinating. It feels wonderful and fascinating.
Well, let me ask you this, Ron. As you have now followed Owen into adulthood, there are moments in his life that you can't help him with because he's got to be on his own. What has that been like for you? And you obviously get into some of that in this film.
Yeah, well, you know, look, Owen is more and more living his own life out in the world. And part of this movie is about all the things, again, all parents go through, which is letting them go, releasing them. And what's fascinating about us watching the movie is we get to hear the voices of our children, actually, in ways that we don't otherwise hear them through the movie. And it's actually given us even more confidence than we've ever had that Owen will be okay as he goes forward. You know, he's making sense of the world at a very high level, using myth, fable, and legend, using the content he loves, the movies and other things. So actually, it's helped us lessen fears that we once had. And part of it is Owen uses voices that are part of our voices, like just the question you just mentioned, Jeremy. You know, I think that, Owen, would that be the Sebastian scene?
It would definitely be the Sebastian
scene.
Well,
tell Jeremy which scene you use in your head.
At the end of The Little Mermaid, where Sebastian King Triton discuss Ariel's happy end wish to become human, King Triton says, "She really does love him, doesn't she, Sebastian?" "Well, it's like I always say, Your Majesty. Children have got to be free to lead their own lives. Like you always say, Sebastian." "And I guess there's just one problem left." "And what's that, Your Majesty?" "How much I'm going to miss her."
"Then I guess there's just one problem left."
"And what's that, Your Majesty?"
"How much I'm going to miss her."
You know, Jeremy, Owen played that scene for us the night before he left for his college program and really sort of set out into the world.
Yeah.
And he played that scene. Cornelia and I were in the basement with him. And then he paused it and looked at us and said, "Are we okay?" And Cornelia says, "Of course, honey. We will miss you terribly. But that's because we love you. That's the way it should be. And we're all going to be fine." And Owen said, "Okay, great." And off he went. But you see, he does what all of us do. We find in the mirror of movies, of art, of literature, of the symbolic representations that we create as humans to, well, hold those mirrors up to see ourselves, not just who we are, but maybe who we want to be.
Well, and in this film, you show that he's started a Disney club with others. And I wonder, have you found anyone that has the exact same way of looking at the world and communication through Disney?
Zillions of
zillions.
Them.
Yeah, zillions. And I still have a few more to meet ahead.
You know, and look, Disney Club, we saw 12 kids just like Owen. 2 years later, there were 40. And this is the way many folks on the spectrum use their passions. They use them as pathways, as code breakers of themselves and their place in the world. And Disney Club, that was great, wasn't it?
It sure was.
Why did you start Disney Club?
To have more people get to know me who are like me.
Did it work?
It sure did.
Owen, what's it like to live on your own now in your own apartment?
Feels good and much better.
And Ron, what is it like for you to watch him be in his own place?
It's exciting. You know, we never knew, Cornelia and I, what to expect going ahead. That's why we often lived in the present with Owen, almost like we were afraid to think of the future too much. Now we see Owen evermore as a captive of his own ship. But look, he will always be an autistic man or a man with autism. You know, this isn't a spell that gets broken. But, you know, ultimately he's now moving his own life forward. And that's very exciting for us to watch.
And Roger Ross Williams, do you have a better understanding now of why this world of Disney worked for Owen? Were you able to learn anything about that as you did this?
You know, when I started this film, I didn't know anyone living with autism. And so my goal in the film was always to really show the world through Owen's eyes. And I, not only did I learn so much about people living with autism, but I learned that Owen has so much to teach me as a storyteller and as a filmmaker. He made me a better filmmaker making this film. He made me a better storyteller, and it was an enriching experience. And I think when people come to see the film, you know, the film starts out and you may be uncomfortable because you see Owen pacing and talking. But by the end of the film, you know exactly what's going on in his head, and that sort of uncomfortableness has gone away.
You know, somebody, Jeremy, you know, I think years from now, people will say, hey, I thought that kid in that movie was one in a million. And they'll say, no, he's one of a million. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Well, the film is called Life Animated. Roger Ross Williams, the director, the executive producer, Ron Suskind, and, of course, Owen Suskind, the star. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
We spoke with Owen and Ron Suskind and Roger Ross Williams last June. Life Animated is on the short list for nominees for Best Documentary. The Academy Award nominations will be announced on January 24th. You can see the short list at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original Before You Go Toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Scientists in San Antonio, Texas, are working on a new way to get medications into the body. It's an innovation that may have far-reaching implications for all kinds of patients with chronic diseases. Wendy Rigby of Texas Public Radio explains how tiny implants could help save lives.
Cancer, HIV, diabetes. These potentially deadly diseases require daily medications. Biomedical and mechanical engineer Lyle Hood is developing new engineering tools to deliver the drugs.
Having better solutions to cure these degenerative, wasting diseases where somebody is going to die, but they're not going to die well, is absolutely a central passion of mine.
The University of Texas at San Antonio professor is working with colleagues to develop a tiny capsule. The idea is to use the capsule to place medications precisely where they need to go in a non-invasive way. The drug delivery device can be placed in the body through a needle.
This device is a cylinder. It's 3 millimeters long and 1 millimeter in diameter, so it's basically the head of your pen.
For cancer patients, this could be a new way to deliver immunotherapy drugs, the kind that recruit the immune system to recognize cancer cells as a threat and eradicate them. Right now, immunotherapy has to be injected, and the body clears it quickly. The system Hood is working on would act like a reservoir, providing a regulated release of therapy over time. Weeks, and perhaps even months.
The kind of secret sauce of this device that makes it special, it's a nanochannel membrane.
Nanochannels are tiny holes etched in a silicon chip, thousands of holes per square centimeter that transmit fluids. With varying numbers and sizes, engineers can control the diffusion, tailoring the device to each drug, controlling rates and dosages. The first incarnation of the capsule was metal. Now, Hood and his team are developing a biodegradable version. Using a 3D printer, engineers will be able to fabricate versions of the capsule that will dissolve in the body, explains Hood.
We are working on developing a device that is implantable through a needle, is approximately the same size, but is going to be made entirely of polymer, will release drugs over a couple of weeks, but will biodegrade over a couple of months and just go away.
Ultimately, patients may be able to simply swallow the biodegradable version. Right now, the technology has been tried in rats and mice, and tests on people are expected in the next few years. Doctoral student Fouad Akhtar is excited about the possible results from this cutting-edge project.
We are actually trying to invent a new thing. We are looking for a solution which can save lots of people's lives.
An article featuring Hood's work was recently featured in the Journal of Biomedical Nanotechnology. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
And this medical-related note, thousands of people braved freezing temperatures in Michigan yesterday to hear Senator Bernie Sanders denounce Republican efforts to repeal President Obama's health care law. Labor unions were a strong presence at the rally in Macomb County, just outside Detroit, one of dozens staged by Democrats across the country, including in Los Angeles, Chicago, Richmond, Virginia, and Portland, Oregon. President-elect Donald Trump has said he will overturn and replace the Affordable Care Act. And in a weekend interview with the Washington Post, he said his replacement would provide insurance for everybody, but so far no details. Republicans in Congress have taken the first steps toward repealing Obamacare. We will stay tuned.
The nation is marking Martin Luther King Day today with events and ceremonies, and we'd like to take a few minutes to listen back to King's own words. Before he was assassinated in 1968, he often reflected on his own mortality because there had been many threats against him. Here he is in a sermon that came to be known as Shattered Dreams, first delivered in 1959.
So many of us in life start out building temples, temples of character, temples of justice, temples of peace. So often we don't finish them. Because life is like a Schubert's unfinished symphony. At so many points we start, we try, we set out to build our various temples. And I guess one of the great agonies of life is that we are constantly trying to finish that which is unfinishable.
The speech that really made Martin Luther King famous came at the end of the March on Washington in 1963. He spoke at the Lincoln Memorial in the nation's capital.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. That one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Less than a month after that, four young black girls were killed when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, was bombed. King took to the pulpit to eulogize them.
These children, unoffending, innocent, and beautiful, were the victims of one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity. And yet they died nobly. They are the martyred herons of a holy crusade for freedom and human dignity. And so this afternoon, in a real sense, they have something to say to each of us in their death. They have something to say to every minister of the gospel who has remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows.
As he struggled to come to terms with the violence directed at the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He accepted the honor on December 10, 1964.
The torturous road which has led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo bears witness to this truth. This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling to find a new sense of dignity.
The next year, in 1965, Dr. King led the marches for voting rights for African Americans across the South. On March 25th, Dr. King spoke to the marchers from the steps of the Alabama State Capitol.
Today I want to say to the state of Alabama,
yes, sir.
Today I want to say to the people of America and the nations of the world that we are not about to turn around.
Yes, sir.
We are on the move now.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we're on the move, and no wave of racism can stop us.
Yes, sir.
We are moving to the land of freedom.
Yes, sir.
Let us therefore continue.
Running parallel to civil rights in the 1960s, there were growing protests against the Vietnam War. On April 4th, 1967, Martin Luther King spoke at Riverside Church in New York City. He did what many of his followers had wanted him to do. He linked the movements.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
A year to the day after the speech on the Vietnam War, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis. That happened on April 4th, 1968. The night before, he delivered what turned out to be his final speech. King was in Memphis to highlight the injustice felt by the city's sanitation workers who were on strike over low pay and working conditions. But near the end of that speech, he said this.
Now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane,
and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis on April 3rd, 1968. He was killed the next day. Yesterday would have been his 88th birthday. This month marks an important benchmark for baby boomers. The oldest baby boomers are now hitting 70 and a half, and the government requires that anyone that age or older withdraw money from tax-advantaged retirement accounts like 401ks. Now, since this is the largest generation so far to retire, those withdrawals will amount to hundreds of billions of dollars in the coming years. So what does it mean for the economy? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So there are around 75 million baby boomers. And as we said, some of them are now turning 70 and a half. How much do they have to withdraw?
Well, you know, it's based on each person's life expectancy as well as the amount of money in the retirement account. And so every single person has a slightly different amount that has to be withdrawn. This is really interesting because in many respects, a lot of people say, of course, they knew they were doing that. They were saving for a future event. But I think some are still surprised that at 70 and a half, the government says, no, you have to start actually pulling money out at this point.
And this applies to what kind of retirement accounts?
So these are from tax sheltered retirement accounts. So just think of anything that you got some sort of tax benefit from. It could be a 401k, a 403b, a 457 if you worked for a municipality, IRA accounts, but not for a Roth IRA, right? Because you didn't get a tax benefit. You put an after tax dollar in. The requirements are very stringent. I really have to underscore that, because whatever you're supposed to take, whatever that amount is for you, if you don't take it, Uncle Sam will slap a massive penalty on you. It's usually up to 50% of what you should have withdrawn in that year.
So for people that don't want to get that penalty and decide, okay, fine, I have to take this money out, I will take it out, what do you think they should do with it, especially if they don't feel that they need it right now? Can they reinvest it?
Well, a lot of people will call my show up and they'll say, oh, well, I just want to roll it into another tax-deferred account. You can't do that. I mean, you are actually going to have to pay tax due on whatever comes out of that account. But as you say, most people actually need that money. They need to use it to help support them. But if you don't need it, you can reinvest the money. And there's certainly a bunch of people in their 70s and 80s. Maybe they've got really great pension plans. Maybe they don't need the money right now. And what they do is they take the money out and then they just have a regular traditional brokerage account, no tax advantage to that. And they reinvest it into maybe something different, maybe something the same. But essentially, just remember, as soon as that money comes out, You pay Uncle Sam. Whatever you do next is an after-tax dollar. There's no special tax savings you can do. With one caveat, there is a way to take money out for your required distribution and give it to charity, and that avoids the taxation that Uncle Sam would normally give to an individual.
What does this mean for mutual funds and brokerage firms that have been seeing all this money from baby boomers coming in over all these years and are now going to see some of that go out?
Time to pay the piper, gang. That's the problem. If you build your entire business based on accumulation, right, which is saving for retirement, when you have decumulation, taking money out, your business is going to change. So what are all these big firms going to have to do? They're going to have to say, here is a way that makes it really easy to stay within my firm, right? That's not easy because at the moment I take my money out, I start looking up and saying, wait, there's lots of different options. I don't have to have a managed mutual fund. I can use an exchange-traded fund, an index fund, a robo-advisor. It causes consumers to rethink their options.
So what's the overall impact on the economy of all these boomers taking money out of their accounts?
Well, I mean, look, there, for years we have been told that when boomers retire, they will stop spending money and therefore the economy will grind to a halt. I don't buy that. I mean, I think a lot of people in their 70s are still spending money and they're living longer, they're living healthier. And I think that that's a great thing. What it does mean, however, is that the mutual fund companies, the investment advisors out there, the big asset managers, what they have got to figure out is how are we going to refill our coffers? They have set their sights on the millennials, but we know from tons of research, millennials are very mistrustful of the investment advisory business and in all of investment services. They tend to be decent savers, although they spend a lot on coffee, evidently, but they are not great investors. So they save, but they don't invest. So what does this really mean for the economy? Financial service companies, they're going to have to sit up and offer these millennials a reason to do business with them. And it either has to be a great value proposition. It has to be that they feel convinced that they are being put first. So maybe it's embracing the fiduciary standard. Who knows? But I think these companies are shifting to the millennials, presuming that it's just going to happen. I think they're going to have to make a much better pitch to get that business.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.